It's Friday, March 6th. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update podcast. Ahead, Republicans pass a top education reform measure in the Minnesota House. Transportation brings two of the state's most powerful DFLers together again. We hear a leading voice on race in the Twin Cities. A Twin Cities company butts heads with an environmental group, No More. The Saints go moving in. Minnesotans bike across Alaska in winter. And the Minnesota Opera takes on a popular story. Minnesota House Republicans have passed their top education policy bill of the session, but its prospects for becoming law appear to be dim. Lawmakers voted 70-63 last night, largely along party lines for the measure, which makes changes to teacher seniority and licensing rules. Tim Pugmire reports.
Under the bill backed by Republicans, school district officials would be required to negotiate local layoff policies that factor in teacher performance, rather than basing those decisions solely on years of service. It would end the practice known as last in, first out, by the start of the 2017-2018 school year. Republican Representative Jennifer Loon of Eden Prairie said parents want the best teachers in classrooms, not just the most senior teachers.
I'm not asking to get rid of seniority. I'm simply asking that our districts negotiate a fuller, more thoughtful process for what would happen if a layoff occurs in your district, and one in which the interests of our students, doing what's best for our students, really is at the heart of that decision-making process.
The bill also orders the Board of Teaching to speed up the process for out-of-state teachers to get licensed in Minnesota. Another provision makes it easier for school districts to hire non-licensed community experts for some openings when licensed teachers are not available. But most of the debate focused on layoffs. Republican Representative Peggy Bennett of Albert Lea said the legislation makes sense. A teacher, Bennett said she thinks her school colleagues will be comfortable with the layoff policy changes.
This is not about picking on teachers. We have awesome teachers. I know many, many good teachers in my district and outside of my district. What this bill does is, in the unfortunate event of a layoff, it allows us to keep the best teachers.
Business groups, including the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, support the bill. The state teachers union, Education Minnesota, opposes it, as do most Democrats in the state legislature. DFL Representative Jim Dabney of Minneapolis, who is also a teacher, warned that the bill will result in unhealthy competition among educators.
It turns that collaborative culture on its head and says, look out for yourself. Look out for number one, and don't look out for your kids. Don't look out for the other students in the school by sharing and collaborating and working with your fellow staff.
Governor Mark Dayton vetoed a similar teacher layoff bill in 2012. He said this week that he'll wait to see what develops with the legislation this session before making a judgment. Still, the Democratic governor said Republicans are focusing on the wrong education issue.
Less than 2% of Minnesota teachers are laid off in the last 5 years, even during the recession and the cutbacks in funding. So, meanwhile, a third of the teachers leave the profession in less than 5 years. So the real issue we have in terms of the quality of education for our kids is about recruiting and retaining good teachers.
Democrats in the Minnesota Senate are also resistant to the proposed seniority changes, even though DFL Senator Terry Bonhoff of Minnetonka is pushing a bill there. Bonhoff said she'll get a committee hearing next week.
Do I think that I've got the votes to get that bill off the Senate floor? No, I don't think I do.
But even without Senate passage, Bonhoff said the House action will keep the issue alive for end-of-session negotiations. She said she remains optimistic.
I think that it won't be an easy path, but it's my belief that when we adjourn sine die, that this provision will be part of the final deal.
DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach of Cook said it's wrong for the legislature to get involved in the collective bargaining process. Still, Bach anticipates the full Senate will take a vote on the issue sometime this session, probably as a floor amendment to another bill. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Governor Dayton and DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach appear to have patched up their differences. They launched a unified effort yesterday to put House Republicans on the spot over transportation funding. They say Republicans don't have a realistic plan to fix roads, bridges, and transit, and Democrats will push a 10-year plan to improve Minnesota's transportation system. Tom Scheck has the story.
Governor Dayton didn't mince words when it comes to the House Republican transportation plan, calling it fiction.
And all we get from House Republicans and even Senate Republicans is, whack at this and whack at that and rant about this and rant about that, and with nothing coming forward other than, a slice of the surplus and a double dose of make-believe.
Dayton said House Republicans should release details of how they'll pay to fix the state's long-term transportation problems. Dayton has proposed a 10-year, $6 billion plan that increases the wholesale tax on gasoline and raises vehicle registration fees to pay for road and bridge projects. He also wants a half-cent sales tax increase in the metro area to pay for transit projects. In January, House Republicans proposed using a portion of the state's budget surplus and money already in the Transportation Department budget to spend about $750 million for road and bridge projects over the next 4 years. Dayton said GOP leaders need to stop talking about his plan and release more specifics of their own.
I urge the House to step up. They're co-governing with us, and they need to take on that responsibility, quit whacking at the panada of my proposal, and come forward with your own, a real proposal, a real plan, and tell us what it's going to do and tell us what it's not going to do for the people of Minnesota.
As he made his comments, Dayton was flanked by his cabinet and several DFL senators, including Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach. Bach said Senate Democrats will not support using surplus money to pay for transportation projects. He said he doesn't want roads and bridges to compete with education and health care.
Nobody should link the state budget surplus to transportation because they're totally different pots of money, and roads and bridges will just never, ever compete at the Capitol in the budget against all of those other priorities that are so important in our communities.
The news conference was the first time Bach and Dayton have appeared in public since their blow-up last month over commissioner pay, when Dayton accused Bach of stabbing him in the back. The two stood next to each other at the beginning of the news conference. When asked later about their relationship, Bach rushed up and jokingly put his arm around the governor.
Let's create a photo op for all of you. We're doing just fine.
Okay.
And actually, we're going to talk budget targets, I think, probably later this week or early next week. So we're doing fine.
But while Bach and Dayton are together, Republican House Speaker Kurt Dout wasn't in the picture. Dout said last week that the expanding budget surplus should mean a gas tax hike is off the table. After Dayton's news conference, House Transportation Chair Tim Kelly of Red Wing says he plans to release the details of the House GOP proposal this month. Kelly declined to say how much it will spend, but said it will likely include money from the surplus, some borrowing, and dedicating existing tax revenues from auto parts, rental cars, and leased vehicles.
These are real dollars. This does mean investment into transportation, and it does not mean a tax increase.
Dayton and Bach's message may also have been aimed at Democrats. Several House DFLers have said the larger budget surplus makes it tougher to support a gas tax hike. Even DFL House Minority Leader Paul Thiessen isn't ruling out using the surplus for transportation.
The Senate and the governor clearly have put out a plan that is going to accomplish a long-term solution. But I think we're also willing to look at other ideas.
Thiessen said if Republicans propose a comprehensive plan that focuses on the whole state, they'll put up nearly half the support needed to pass the bill. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Protesters charged in the December Black Lives Matter demonstration at the Mall of America are scheduled to appear in court for the first time next week. Among them will be Nakima Levy-Pounds. She is a law professor at St. Thomas, and she spoke with Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition.
Why are you putting yourself out there as a force for change?
Well, I've been active in the field of civil rights for a number of years. That's the reason that I went to law school, to fight for justice. It had a lot to do with the fact that I grew up in an inner city community in South Central Los Angeles, and I saw people's rights being violated on a regular basis because they were poor. And so as a kid, seeing the travesty of justice that existed in my community and the impacts of people living on the margins, I decided at 9 years old that I wanted to become an attorney.
You know, I've noticed there are more African-American women coming to the forefront. You're among them here in Minnesota speaking out. Why do you think that is?
Well, as African-American women, we bear the brunt of unfair and unjust laws and policies when we see our fathers, our husbands, our brothers and our sons being impacted by the criminal justice system and being impacted by biased policing. So as a mother of African-American sons, I recognize that I have a responsibility to speak truth to power and to advocate for justice.
Now, you are very active, obviously, and you've written that you're often selected as something of a token representative of communities of color. You sit on policymaking committees and that kind of thing. You participate in all kinds of discussions, public discussions. Can you give me an example of a time when you felt frustrated by lack of diversity in a policymaking setting?
I attended a business circle event at the Guthrie, and that event consisted of Mayor Betsy Hodges giving a presentation on equity in the city. And so prior to the event, there was a reception. I was at the reception. I sat in the corner away from most people. And then I had a lot of people, you know, come over into that area. Several of the people, maybe three or four, were African-American. And that gave me the sense that, you know, there was racial diversity in the room. But once we moved into the auditorium and I looked around, I realized that those three or four African-Americans who would approach me were the only other people of color in the room besides myself. I could not believe it, given the fact that the conversation was about equity. I said, how can we dare have a conversation about racial equity in the city of Minneapolis, and there are four or five people of color in the room?
You mentioned you're the mother of two boys.
Yes.
And you've written a lot, especially after the Ferguson grand jury decision not to indict Officer Wilson for the shooting death of Michael Brown this past fall. And you wrote in your blog, I felt like running in the streets and screaming at the top of my lungs. I long for an outlet to demonstrate the rage I felt at that moment, knowing that no black mother's son is safe from a similar fate in America. How have you talked to your boys about interacting with the police?
One of my sons, who was 12 years old, his name is actually Trayvon. And so when the death of Trayvon Martin happened, we had to have some serious conversations. It really hit home, you know, to be calling my son Trayvon every day and then to be thinking about a slain 17-year-old who should not have had to die under those circumstances. So I talked to them about some of the dangers that they are going to encounter because they are young African-American men. And unfortunately, for African-American boys, their innocence is lost all too soon within society. They're typically not seen as boys. They're seen as men from the time that they turn 11 or 12 years old.
What do you think that is?
I think that society has a preoccupation with this notion of the black man as criminal. And that scares me as a mom to think that the innocence of my children could be lost because we have never solved the race question in this country. And so not only do I talk to them about how to interact with the police, even when we go into department stores, I have to pull them aside and remind them, keep your hands to yourself and stay close to me.
You mentioned we haven't solved the question of race in this country. Yet we've had Black Lives Matter demonstrations, the recent DOJ report about racial bias in the Ferguson Police Department. There's been a lot of attention over matters of race in this country. Do you feel optimistic at all about the conversation at this point? Or is it just the same old, same old?
I'm optimistic to a certain degree. So I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, I've been studying this question of race, particularly with regard to interactions between African-Americans and whites since I was a kid. I think in many ways, race relations have become worse in this country, primarily because so many people feel that we're living in a post-racial society. And that misperception has cost us a great deal because it makes it difficult when you have patterns and practices of discrimination to be able to shine a light on those issues when people have the perception that we're beyond race.
What's behind the disparities in the state of Minnesota?
Well, one of the things that I said to the governor in 2011 was that there are two Minnesotas, one black, one white, both separate and unequal. And so you referenced earlier the fact that the Department of Justice has looked very intently at the practices that were happening in Ferguson, and they found extreme patterns and practices of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would argue that if the DOJ came here to the Twin Cities and they actually exercised due diligence and did a thorough analysis of how our police systems operate, they would find very similar disparities.
You know, we've had an interesting conversation. I've been listening to you carefully here this morning, and I'm wondering, would you ever run for office? Because folks trying to make change say you got to get elected to office to make significant change. Would you ever consider that?
I usually tell people, if God himself, you know, called me into public office, then I would run. And I would have to know, okay, God, that's you, in order for me to do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in the future that I were called into that arena, not because of my own desires to do that, but because of necessity.
I've enjoyed the conversation, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Pressure from a little-known environmental group has led to a new policy on paper sourcing at Twin Cities-based 3M. Forest Ethics argued the maker of Post-it notes was working with suppliers linked to irresponsible forest management and human rights abuses. 3M says the new policy ensures all of its products will be using paper or pulp that will come from reputable sources. Elizabeth Dunbar has more.
Forest Ethics has been a thorn in 3M's side for several years.
Good morning, 3M shareholders. We wanted to let you in on something that 3M has been hiding from you. Many 3M products contain controversially sourced fiber from forests around the world.
That was a radio broadcast targeted at those attending 3M's annual shareholders meeting in Austin, Texas, last May. 2 months later, Forest Ethics hired a plane to circle Target Field during Major League Baseball's All-Star festivities in Minneapolis. That strategy prompted 3M executives to respond publicly. 2 days after the game, Gail Shuler, 3M's vice president for sustainability, even interrupted the panel she was on at a state clean energy summit attended by the governor and other officials to give an explanation.
Some of you may have noticed that there's a group that has protested against us in the NGO community. And I wanted to set the record straight for those of you who might be curious. We agree with that organization about many things, particularly the importance of sustainable forestry management. Where we disagree with that organization is about certification.
Soon after that, the two sides resumed their talks. And today, the group known for its sometimes annoying tactics was on a conference call with 3M to announce the company's new policy. Forest Ethics Executive Director Todd Paglia praised the company for its work.
I've been with my organization for 16 years, and I've worked with a lot of international logging companies and branded Fortune 500 companies. 3M stands alone. The company is known worldwide for its innovative spirit, and today 3M stands alone in a different way, as the largest manufacturer with the most diverse product line to adopt such stringent standards for the use of forest products.
The first part of 3M's new policy involves tracing the origin of all wood, paper, and pulp it buys. Those materials go into making everything from Post-its to masking tape to sandpaper. The company won't source materials from forests that have high conservation value, such as those containing endangered species in places like Canada, Brazil, and Indonesia. Gene Sweeney is 3M Vice President for Environmental, Health, Safety, and Sustainability Operations. She says the cost of implementing the new policy won't be significant. The company doesn't expect the policy to change the prices consumers pay. 3M had already dedicated resources to sustainable forestry, and Sweeney says the company's operating regions around the world now have additional resources to implement the changes.
This is a small price to pay to guarantee our consumers that any 3M product they buy is made from responsibly harvested wood.
3M is among several Minnesota companies that have responded to outside pressure to change their sourcing practices. General Mills and Cargill are working toward using only sustainably sourced palm oil, for example. And Best Buy has switched suppliers for its Sunday advertisement inserts. Tim Smith studies corporate sustainability practices at the University of Minnesota. He says such policy changes aren't only about doing the right thing. He says brand reputations and new financial risks brought on by climate change are also at stake.
Why would they want to do it? So they have to spend less money on advertising or management of their PR, or they can better avoid the sort of supply chain architecture costs of trying to manage an increasingly volatile source of supply.
Under 3M's new policy, the company has already cut ties with a supplier in Indonesia linked to unsustainable logging. Beyond environmental considerations, the company is also looking at human rights. Its suppliers must get permission from indigenous groups and local communities before logging takes place. It's a requirement Forest Ethics says goes above and beyond what most other companies have done. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The St. Paul Saints moved into their new stadium yesterday. The first pitch is still months away, but the team has a new home in downtown St. Paul. Tim Nelson stopped by for a look.
In St. Paul, the Saints don't march in. They arrive on trucks and four-wheeled moving dollies. That's what the loading dock behind CHS Field in St. Paul sounded like today as the St. Paul Minor League Baseball team moved into its new $63 million ballpark in the Lower Town neighborhood.
Tomorrow the phones get turned on and the next era of Saints baseball begins here at CHS Field. We're just so thrilled and grateful.
That's Annie Heidekoper, team vice president, who was unpacking some of the memorabilia the team collected at Midway Stadium, its home since 1993. Movers packed up the team for the six-mile move starting this morning.
There's some historical records and great photographs of Minnie Minoso or Wayne Twilliger or Isla Borders, things, you know, folks like that who played for us.
And like the team's games, there was some baseball involved.
There's still some good bats from last year that we brought over and some uniforms and some training equipment, but really just with the new ballpark, you get a lot of new stuff and fresh equipment, fresh opportunities. It's tremendous.
The ballpark has been under construction for about a year and a half. Demolition of a one-time shampoo plant on the site began in July of 2013, and the first concrete was poured last April. The field lights were lit for the first time this week, and seats are being installed in the stands right now. Sort of.
You are looking at boxes of seats that are getting assembled. I guess some of them are still stuck in port out in L.A., but we'll have them in time. We have 11 weeks to go.
The ballpark is being built by Ryan Construction and will be run by the Saints, although the city of St. Paul will own it. It's supposed to add to the revitalization efforts in the neighborhood that include the Green Line light rail line and the $240 million Union Depot renovation. The Saints will officially vacate their old home at the end of this month. Demolition will start soon after. That'll include the cleanup of a one-time dump site that Midway Stadium was built on, according to Monty Hilleman, Vice President of Real Estate Development for the St. Paul Port Authority.
We have a joint venture partnership with United Properties to construct about 190,000 square foot office warehouse building on the site. That'll bring darn near 300 jobs to the site.
That $17 million project is expected to be finished in early 2016. The first Saints game at the new field is scheduled for May 21st. Single game tickets go on sale on March 21st. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Several Minnesota men are taking a well-deserved rest. They just finished biking their way across 350 miles of rugged Alaskan wilderness on wide, knobby tires. The men took part in the grueling Iditarod Trail Invitational on a route better known for sled dog racing. Peter Cox has more.
Earlier this week, a crowd gathered at the head of the Iditarod Trail. Instead of cheering on dogs and mushers, they screamed for more than 40 cyclists who were about to set off on a long-distance race with the most difficult conditions imaginable. Charlie Tree of Rochester was one of them.
It's an incredibly hard, incredibly difficult, potentially very, very dangerous race with extreme weather and extreme temperatures.
Tree says he survives the temperatures by wearing lots of thin layers. This was the 37-year-old's second race. He finished seventh. The course has checkpoints about every 40 miles, but for the most part, riders are surrounded by snow, trees, mountains, and the occasional moose or wolf.
It's not like someone can drive out and pick you up. Alaskan Air Force has to come out in helicopters to try to get you out of these areas. It's so extremely remote.
Tree finished just behind 39-year-old Ben Doom of St. Cloud. It was Doom's first race. Because the race usually lasts at least 2 days, riders have to decide when and if they're going to sleep. One day, Doom found himself dead tired, running into rocks and stumps.
So I just went 20 feet off the trail, threw down my sleeping pad and sleeping bag, and
slept a solid 2.5 hours. It took me 2 days, 8 hours or so, and I slept probably about 5 hours.
This year was the fastest fat bike Iditarod in the race's 13-year history. Much of the race was done with temperatures above 0 degrees. Jamie Zylstra was happy about that. From her home in Prior Lake, she tracked her husband Ken's progress online. Jamie says in Ken's first race in 2013, temperatures dipped into the negative 30s.
I'm worried every single day that he's out there, because I would say that my nightmare would be to get that phone call that he was, you know, frozen somewhere.
Despite those concerns, she actually pushed him to return to the race this year because he loves it so much.
A lot of people tell me that he's crazy, but for me, I love that he does it because it just brings this peace to him where I just know he's super happy. If I ever stopped him from that, I'd just be crushing his dreams.
At the end of the 350 miles, the racers gather at a lodge where they finally eat a real meal and exchange stories. Here's rider Charlie Tree.
I'm sure it's different for everyone, but the common denominator really is just pushing yourself to the limit and seeing what you're capable of.
He and Doom half joked that they'll join a handful of racers next year who push themselves even further. Those riders go the whole Iditarod course, 1,000 miles. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Opera plunges into the Cold War this weekend with its world premiere adaptation of the political thriller The Manchurian Candidate. UN Care reports the production brings back the team that netted the company a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years back.
The Manchurian Candidate begins building tension from its opening notes. The challenge of creating and maintaining this electric atmosphere attracted composer Kevin Putz.
Even from the very opening, that you hear this pulse and you hear this harmony, but the ground starts to shift under you, and so you never really feel that there's a firm footing. And I think, and the music moved from scene to scene in that way, where you never really are allowed to get comfortable, and nothing is what it seems.
The opera is an adaptation of Richard Condon's best-selling political thriller, published in 1959. It tells the story of Raymond Shaw, a U.S. Army soldier and son of a prominent political couple who is captured during the Korean War. He is brainwashed and trained as an assassin. In a harrowing opening scene, his new masters tell him to kill an army buddy who has also been brainwashed.
Shoot Bobby Lambeck through the forehead, Raymond.
Yes, sir. Hiya, kid.
Hiya, Sarge. What's cooking?
Shaw draws a gun and kills him without displaying a shred of emotion. He's sent back to the U.S., completely unaware his mission is to kill a presidential candidate. His own mother, Eleanor Island, is to set the plan in motion. She's in league with the communists and prepared to use her son for political murder as a way of furthering the career of her new husband, a U.S. senator. Librettist Mark Campbell told an audience after a workshop in December that years ago he saw the operatic nature of the story and her character in particular.
She is the greatest monster in American opera right now, in, at least in my humble opinion.
Yes, I meant that affectionately, really.
Campbell says while this is a Cold War story, its themes of paranoia and fear of unknown malignant forces still have resonance.
This opera is very relevant to our politics to today.
The Manchurian Candidate comes on the heels of Campbell and Putz's first collaboration, Silent Night, which won a Pulitzer for composing. It told the World War I story about the Christmas truce in the trenches of 1914. Minnesota Opera artistic director Dale Johnson says Putz caught lightning in a bottle with what was his first opera score, but believes he can do it again.
Because I think he was born to it, to the idea of singing and the idea of that magic combination of words and singing and orchestral writing.
We're safe now.
Safe now.
With Philly.
Safe now.
Out of harm's way.
Kevin Putz says he finds composing opera easier than other musical compositions that are often open-ended.
But to be given a libretto and it has all this information in it. It has stage directions. You know, the light is coming up from the dawn, and the soldiers are sleeping in the... great, sure, I'll do... You know, I know what to do.
The Minnesota Opera performs The Manchurian Candidate this weekend and next. It's the latest in the company's New Works Initiative, which commissions new American operas in the hope they will go on to be produced elsewhere. Music director Michael Christie believes The Manchurian Candidate could prove timely and attractive around the country.
For companies that could turn around this work and aim towards 2016, 2017, when we're going to have this massive presidential election and everything, I think it could be quite interesting.
But by that time, the Minnesota Opera will be on to its next big commission, an adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining, opening in May next year. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the NPR News Update for Friday and the week. Thanks for finding the Minnesota News Podcast. I'm Phil Picardi, back with news on your schedule for Monday.